Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Tonight, sadly, we come to the end of our series of conversations with New York Times best-selling author Eric Metaxas on the seven great men he's shining a light on in his book, Seven Men and Their Secret of Greatness, from George Washington to Chuck Colson. Over the last few weeks, we've covered great ones from George Washington to William Wilberforce, Eric Liddell to Dietrich Bonhoeffer. They are all well worth catching on the podcast page of our Open House community website. Tonight, Pope John Paul II, and a man very special to Eric Metaxas, former Watergate hatchet man, prison ministry pioneer Charles Colson. Eric, for the final time in this series, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's just a pleasure to get so much time.
Been so grateful that you've given us so much time, Eric. Before we get to these two final great men, you highlight in every one of these stories, actually, the need for courage to be truly great. And you say that having courage means having heart. Tell us what you mean by that.
Yeah, in the introduction to this book, I talk about a number of things that I think are very, very important for men especially to understand. Number one, that courage comes from the root word, the Latin word cur, or French cur, Latin cor, which means heart. So to have courage means to have heart. Not heart in a Valentine's mushy romantic way, to have heart like to be lion-hearted. We say Richard the Lion-hearted. What does it mean to be lion-hearted? It means to be great in a deep, brave, heroic way. And it's interesting because C.S. Lewis writes about men without chests, this idea of being hollow, and how we really see biblically when God says, take courage, or he says, take heart, this idea of having a lion heart, a great heart, somehow is at the core of what it means to be a man. And I think that you see that in all of these stories, but in the introduction to the book Seven Men, I get into this because I do think it's important for young men especially to understand God's idea of manhood. The world's idea of manhood doesn't talk of that kind of thing. We've lost that, and it is extremely important for any parents with boys that they're trying to raise. They need to be able to help them to understand this. It's at the heart of what it means to be a man.
I'm passing it on to my son, and I hope he does the same to my three grandsons as well, because I think you're really onto something very significant. So let's go to Pope John Paul II, who became Pope in 1978. His homeland was Poland, and he had a tremendously strong bond with his dad. In fact, as a child, he saw his father on his knees in prayer, and that image never left him.
Yeah, it's incredible how devout he was. I mean, in my experience growing up in the United States here, a lot of people say, "Oh, I'm Catholic," but they're not devout. They say, "I'm Catholic because it's an ethnic background and we've always gone to this church." Here you see a picture of profound Christian faith in the Catholic Church in Poland at the time that the Pope was a young man, very prayerful. His father was prayerful. These are holy people. There's just no doubt about it that they're holy. They take God very seriously, constantly praying, constantly going to church. The young man who would become the Pope was absolutely brilliant. Anybody who knows his story knows that he was just a genius. So here you have a combination of a tremendous mind and a tremendous man of prayer. It's just a rare thing, and it's a beautiful thing.
So the death of his dad was a devastating thing for him.
There's no doubt about it. His mother died when he was quite young. He was close to his father, of course, and his father died when I think he was in his early 20s. And then his brother died. I can't remember when, but he just loses everybody, just devastating, suffering. And you can just imagine to lose both parents and your beloved older brother, it was very, very tough. So he really became even more devout as a result of this suffering. And he was very quickly noticed by the church leadership, and they wanted to recruit him to become a priest. He was somebody, he didn't plan on that. He was a playwright. He did all these extraordinary things. He was a great athlete. But eventually, of course, he found his way into the church.
He was ordained just after the end of World War II and eventually developed a very strong bond with Pope Paul.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I learned all this myself, you know, doing the research. I was surprised by all of this. And that's one of the fun things about a book like this is the things you learn, you say, my goodness, how did I not know that? But to think that he was friends, as he rose in the ranks of the church, he became close with Pope Paul and was an advisor. It is interesting that he was being groomed, that's clear, by the Lord, I think, but also by the leaders.
Describe to us then what John Paul was like as Pope, how people came to view him, Eric.
I remember I was 15 years old when he became Pope, and I say in the book that I remember when Pope Paul died, they picked another Pope, and all the pomp and circumstance and the white smoke goes up and all this stuff happens. And I wasn't Catholic, but it was unavoidable. You couldn't, you know, you turn on the TV, look at the Time magazine, all this stuff about the new Pope. And about a month later, that Pope died. That Pope was John Paul I.
Yes.
So suddenly now the Curia has to pick another Pope. It's crazy. And this time, it's almost funny, they decide maybe we'll go with a younger guy this time, you know. And who do they pick? This vibrant 58-year-old great athlete, great brain from Poland. I mean, when had there been a Pope that was not from Italy, not for centuries?
Yeah.
So it was a very dramatic thing. And he was different. I mean, even at the time, even I remember that there was an openness to him, a kind of joy. When you think of a pope, you think of an old man or sort of a clerical figure. This was a man, there was joy on his face, hope, life. And as soon as he became pope, you know, he made it very clear that he was going to be somehow different. There was that joy right from the beginning, a humility, and he wades into the crowd at some point, and he's shaking hands and blessing people, and the popes didn't do that. Up for years, they had been very, you know, reserved figures. They didn't do things like this, and so he charmed the whole world. It was very, very powerful and promising beginning.
In the words of Jesus, he always had the least of these, the weak and the needy, on his radar.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. And, of course, what goes along with that is he was a champion of unborn life. There's no doubt that he took that very seriously, that any life, but especially the weak and the needy, needs protection, that those of us who are strong need to protect the weak. And so he was very outspoken in that. He was outspoken against stem cell research. Some folks will remember that, you know, embryos were being created. Well, guess what embryos are? They're human beings in tiny form. They were being created to later be destroyed in research for this idea that it could help Alzheimer's patients or something, and he stood against this. And what's really dramatic is that he stood against this although he himself had Parkinson's disease. The one disease that people were saying that the stem cells could cure, he stood against it because he knew that you have to honor God. And God says life, human life, is sacred. It doesn't matter if it's a zygote, an embryo, a fetus. This is nothing but human life. And he stood up for it heroically when you realize that he himself suffered terribly from Parkinson's.
Yes. He had an attempt on his life in May 1981 and forgave the gunman.
That's also unforgettable if you lived through it as I did, just to remember that the Pope was shot, a Turkish assassin, you know, with a semi-automatic pistol, shot the Pope four times, two times in his abdomen. The Pope lost nearly three-quarters of his blood. Just imagine this. So he was very, very close to death, but he survived. And it really was kind of a miracle. There's just no doubt about it. He was 61 years old at the time. And a while later, I don't know if it was a year later, I can't remember, or 2 years later, he went to the prison where this assassin was, and he went into the cell and met with him and forgave him. It's just an amazing picture of a man living his faith.
It's probably worth saying that This was a crucial time in world history, Eric, with the Cold War, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, and he didn't shy away from playing a part in these huge events.
Folks who know that period of history know that Pope John Paul II, Margaret Thatcher, and Ronald Reagan were a kind of troika of lion-hearted figures who stood up to what Ronald Reagan called the evil empire of Soviet communism, and we forget how evil it was. It was just as against liberty, freedom, as we can imagine. And these three figures, I would say led by Pope John Paul II, stood against it resolutely, and we forget that how effective it is when we stand against something resolutely. They would not give up. And the Pope John Paul II, you know, he went to Poland. Of course, he was from Poland. He had lived under this Soviet tyranny himself, and he gave hope to these people. He told them to stand up for their faith, to live out their faith. I mean, to say that in a communist country was very powerful. But he did say it, and it gave encouragement to the budding solidarity movement at the time, led by Lech Walesa, and really encouraged them in their protest. Just, a very heroic thing that this Pope did.
The main thing you want to emphasize in the book is the sacrifice that is common to all of these seven men, and in his case, it's that Parkinson's disease. He could have quite easily walked away from the papacy, especially as his health declined, but he chose not to. He sacrificed that chance to walk away from it all.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. I remember, you know, when you think of him as a young man, and when he was 58, when he first became Pope, he was a vibrant young man. I mean, he was jogging around the Vatican, and he was, you know, skiing and all these things. And then you see what happened to him later in life. Of course, these bullets from this assassin compromised his health dramatically. He got Parkinson's disease. And later in life, he was a very different figure. He was stooped over, very slow, had difficulty speaking. He was suffering. He was suffering, but he would not hide away. He had always said, life is life. Life is created in the image of God. Human life is created in the image of God. And here we have now a picture in the Pope himself of a man who says, yes, I'm not who I used to be, but I have the dignity of being created in the image of God, and I will be out there, even if I'm drooling, even if I'm stooped over, even if I'm struggling to do anything. I'm a picture to the world of how our weakness is made perfect in the strength of Jesus Christ. And he lived it, and as I say, this was an encouragement to so many people around the world, that even as he grew weaker and weaker, he was willing to just be the Pope, even if he couldn't do much, but just to be there and to be a picture of weak humanity perfected by Christ and submission to Christ, dramatic sacrifice on his part, to be sure.
What a sacrifice. So that's Pope John Paul II, final one of the seven men whose stories you tell in the book. Charles Colson is one you had the privilege of knowing personally, a man you truly loved.
When I think of Chuck, it's hard because I did love him, and especially toward the end of his life, I got to know him much better. I worked for him at Breakpoint Radio 15, 16 years ago. I was one of the writers and editors there, and I knew him and got to know him more over the years as I moved on with my life. But when my Bonhoeffer book came out, Chuck Colson just flipped. He loved that book. He would talk about it wherever he went. And to me, it was like getting the Father's blessing. I thought, this man that I revered for years, for him to speak so glowingly of something that I wrote, but it really did grab him, because the story of Bonhoeffer touched on a lot of the issues that were important to Chuck, namely religious freedom, I would say is the number one thing, the idea of religious freedom and how the Nazis were encroaching on that, and how in the U.S. today and in other Western countries, the governments are encroaching on the sphere of the church and beginning to curb our free speech to speak biblically about biblical sexuality or whatever, that this is something that Bonhoeffer faced. And so Chuck really saw some parallels. And so we became closer in latter years. He invited me to MC conferences and to speak with him. And I was there when he was stricken. I introduced his last speech. And I just, there's no question that he influenced my life tremendously. When I first became a Christian, I was reading all of his books. So just a joy to know him and to see the authenticity of his faith, that this is not just somebody who was a publicly Christian, he was privately Christian.
Eric, let me take you back. Paint us a picture of this highly ambitious young lawyer, where he ended up and what happened to him there when he found himself at the center of presidential power.
Yeah, so many people don't know the story. Of course, in Australia, you might not know it, but the younger generation here in the U.S. doesn't know it. Chuck Colson, when I was a kid, he had an office next to the President of the United States. He was Richard Nixon's special counsel, tremendous political power, tremendous brain, tremendous ambition. He was at the top of the world. And then, of course, the Watergate scandal began to rise up. And just as that was happening, Chuck dramatically found faith in Jesus Christ. It was really before the Watergate scandal hit. But he found faith, and when the scandal broke, Chuck was ready. He was ready with his faith. And the world couldn't believe it. People were, journalists were mocking him because they said, how can this tough guy, this nasty political operator, how could he possibly have become, you know, Mr. Nice Guy Christian? This is just all for show. Well, it wasn't for show. It was the real deal. And in a time when we have so many politicians, you know, doing terrible things and redeeming themselves, you know, minutes later and saying, you know, all should be forgiven. This is a man who really was humbled, but his faith was real. And so the sacrifice he made is when the scandal crashed, he was given the possibility of a plea bargain to get out of going to jail. And in order to take this plea bargain and to avoid jail time, now imagine having this incredible power and suddenly being faced with maybe going to jail. Yes. Anybody would say, well, okay, what do I do to stay out? Tell me what to do. And the lawyer said, well, it's very easy. You will say that you did this instead of this, and I'll get you out of jail. This is an easy one. And Chuck says, well, then I have to lie. We've got a small problem. I can't do that. And the lawyer went crazy. So you've got to be insane.
Yeah.
Anybody would take this. You must take it. Take it for your family. Do the right thing. Don't be ridiculous. He couldn't do it. He said, I've got to do the right thing. So he did the right thing, and he went to jail. Now, it's just incredible to think of this man who was on Air Force One, who was just feted by the world leaders, going to a jail, to a terrible jail. But he said, I'm going to go, and God's going to go with me. And he did. And this sacrifice, you know, there were other sacrifices. When he got out of jail, he made another great sacrifice. He said, guess what? I'm going to go back into jail. I don't need to, but I feel God's leading me to form a prison ministry to help these men and eventually many women in all of these prisons across the U.S. to give them hope, to lead them to faith. And he did that with the rest of his life, with 35 years remaining. He was a devout Christian who lived his faith and who helped the least of these, the prisoners. I mean, when you see that, you just think, look what God can do. It is extraordinary.
And another highly significant sacrifice, because after his prison sentence, he could have just left jail, got on with his life as best he could, and retreat as a private citizen.
He could have made a lot of money as a lawyer. He would have had a very lucrative law practice. But he simply felt that he wanted to serve God, and he felt God was leading him to go back into the prisons to minister to prisoners. And when you think of, you know, Martha Stewart here in the U.S. and so many other figures, they don't ever want it mentioned that they were in prison. They just move on with their lives. He reminded himself of it every single day. He was the head of Prison Fellowship Ministries, a noble, beautiful life. I have to say that, you know, it's another case of a lot of these men in this book did great things, but what do we know them for? Do we know Chuck? Do we say, wow, he was a brilliant lawyer and he was a great advisor to the president? We don't even care. We practically don't care about that. Jeez. We say that, look what happened after he fell, after he was humiliated publicly. He gives his life to God and spends decades serving prisoners, writing books, just doing all of these things, and how he changed my life. I mean, if I was the only one, he affected me profoundly.
And the impact of prison fellowship around the world today, Eric, what is it?
Oh, it's in over 100 countries. It is really amazing. And I think of Chuck as a kind of Wilberforce of our time, because the ramifications of what he did, I mean, the prisoners that have been touched as a result of these decisions Chuck made in the mid-70s, for all of these years, prisoners and their spouses and their children have been affected. Some people know about the Angel Tree program. That's an amazing program. Yes. I hope folks will look it up on the internet.
Yep.
But Angel Tree is a program where people buy presents for the children of prisoners, because these prisoners, they can't go shopping in prison. At Christmas time, their kids get no gifts. And Angel Tree is something that Chuck headed up, and it's been going on for all of these Christmases. But so many things that he did. And then, of course, it went around the world. I'm friends with Mike Timmis, who is in Michigan, here in the U.S. He's the head of the International Prison Fellowship that's in all these countries. So I rejoice to see what God can do through one life.
Yes. You mentioned before that you actually introduced him for what would become his last speech in March 2012. Tell us briefly what happened there.
Well, it is amazing. I was the MC of this conference, and I was speaking at this conference. And the thing is that I hadn't seen Chuck for a while. I was a speaker at the National Prayer Breakfast here in the States, a great honor. I met President Obama, and Chuck wasn't there. I heard that he was sick, and I was really looking forward to seeing him this day because I hadn't seen him in a while. And when I saw him, I saw that he was pretty infirm for Chuck. He'd always been really strong. I think he was just about 80, and he looked sickly. And when we went to the podium, he was walking, sort of shuffling like an old man. I said, I've never seen him like this. I hope he's okay. I hope he recovers soon. It's hard to see him like this. And we get to the podium. I spoke for a while, and then I introduced him. And while he was speaking, I saw him kind of his knees buckling a little bit. He just didn't look steady. And my colleague on Breakpoint, we leapt up at one point because it looked almost like he was going to fall down. And we put him in a chair, and he kept speaking. But he was having a stroke. And when the ambulance took him away, I had the privilege of putting my hand on his shoulder and speaking with him. And I didn't know that I would never speak with him again. But he went into a coma the next day and never came out of it. And I have to say that when he was on his deathbed and we knew that he was dying, that's when I said, I've got to put him in this book. I wouldn't put any living people in this book, Seven Men. But I said, Chuck is going to be with the Lord, and he needs to be the seventh man. And for anybody who's interested, he bumped Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln would have been the seventh man, but Chuck bumped Lincoln, and they're probably talking about it right now. So I have to tell you, it was such a joy to put him in this book, and he was someone that I loved. And I to see him go out also giving a speech on the things that he cared about, it really was a beautiful way to go, I have to say.
Yeah, what a privilege. And before he lapsed into the coma, he did say something to his family about his funeral service.
Yeah, he was adamant, and again, as all Christians should be, he was adamant that he's not going to a bad place. He's going to be with his Father in heaven, with Jesus. He's going to paradise. And he wanted his funeral to be a celebration. You know, he wanted people to know that this is not, you know, of course we're sad in the natural, but this man was going to be with the Lord. And he really was adamant about that. And I was at his memorial service. It was a beautiful, beautiful event. But it was not sad. It was joyful because we knew where he was going, where he had gone, and we should rejoice in that.
It's a wonderful end and a deeply personal end to the most fabulous book. I wish you every success with it, Eric Metaxas, and it's been great having you with us over the last 4 weeks speaking about Seven Men and the secret of their greatness. We'll put the details up on our Open House Community Facebook page. So grateful for all the time you've given us. Thanks so much, Eric.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and folks can find out more at my website. It's just my name, ericmetaxas.com, but I'm just privileged to have been with you for 4 weeks. Thank you, Lee.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.